Welcome to the Blue Sky Podcast,
brought to you by Cambridge University Science Magazine.
I'm Ruby.
And I'm Simone.
Every 2 weeks, we speak to local researchers, university staff and students, and anyone who works in science to learn about their research and activities, hear about the work that they do, and uncover what goes on behind the scenes.
If you want to get in touch with a question, suggestion, or just want to be featured on the podcast, just drop us a tweet. Our handle is at BlueSciPod.
And you can also email us at bluescipodcast@gmail.com.
The Blue Sky Podcast is sponsored by Griner Bio One, who supply laboratory, diagnostic, and medical products to research institutions, higher education, the NHS, and others across the UK. For details of their full product range, visit www.gbo.com.
The Blue Sky Podcast is sponsored by Nature Careers. If you get a chance, take a look at Nature Careers' new funding website, which collates thousands of international funding and grant opportunities. So whether you're looking for an undergrad or postgrad scholarship, fellowships, or funding for a project, try a search at naturecareersfunding.com.
Welcome back to the Blue Sky Podcast. Our guest this week is Dr. Fotis Sampatsiotis, a postdoctoral researcher in the Valier Group at the Wellcome MRC Cambridge Stem Cell Institute at the University of Cambridge. He works in the field of regenerative medicine, collaborating with clinicians and surgeons at Addenbrooke's Hospital, and is part of a team that has recently shown how bile duct organoids, which are mini organs that are grown in the lab using human cells, can be used to repair damaged human livers. We spoke to him about this exciting breakthrough, the science behind organoids and regenerative medicine, and how this technology could be applied in the future to other organs or diseases.
Okay, welcome to the podcast. Thank you very much for joining us. Could you start us off by telling us a little bit about your research?
Thank you very much, and thank you for this invitation. So I would say that my research focuses on regenerative medicine on bile ducts. So that's two parts. There's the regenerative medicine part, and there's the bile duct diseases. So if I were to start from regenerative medicine, what we do when we say that we're doing regenerative medicine is we grow cells in the lab, and our ultimate goal is to generate replacement parts to repair damaged organs. And what's the importance of that? We know that for any human disease, as the disease progresses, there comes a point where drugs stop being helpful. And the disease keeps progressing, the organ gets more and more and more damaged. And at that point of the disease, which we call end-stage disease, the only solution we have is transplantation, changing the organ that's terminally damaged for a new one. However, that's a huge problem. It's a huge problem because there's never enough organs to go around. So there's a lot of patients who die on the transplant waiting list. And the patients who receive organs also have problems. Sometimes the disease comes back in the transplanted organs, whilst it is also a major operation. There are complications. There's the need for long-term immunosuppression. So for a long time, we've been trying to find an alternative. And this is where regenerative medicine comes in. It's an approach which allows us to use these replacement parts to repair the damaged organs and reduce the need for transplantation. So even if we can help some of these organs, that means a lot of patients can be helped. We reduce a little bit the demand and we improve the chances of everybody else who needs a graft to get a transplantation. And of course, you can't treat every disease at the same time. My particular focus was on an organ called the bile ducts and in a group of diseases called bile duct diseases. I'm going to come in the bile ducts in a second, but as a liver doctor, a hepatologist, I have been seeing these diseases in clinic for a long time. And what I could see is that they are diseases which affect children. They affect very young adults. We have no treatment at the moment other than transplantation. And because of that, although it's a rare group of diseases, they affect a little bit over the 30, 40,000 people in the UK. However, their impact is very significant because a lot of them progress to transplantation. So if we look at how many liver transplants are being used up for bile duct diseases, that's a third, almost a third of the transplants we do in the country. It's a very, very significant number. So we try to find, is it possible to grow replacement bile ducts to help not only people who suffer from bile duct disorders, but also all the other people who need a transplant and can't get one because they are too long on the transplant waiting list. And before I go on to tell you how we can make these bile ducts, I think it's fair to explain what the bile ducts are. But obviously stop me if I'm going on for too long.
No, I think it'd be really useful to hear, because obviously, like I, for example, I'm not a biologist at all. And I should probably know more things about, you know, my own body, but I don't. So feel free.
No, that's absolutely, absolutely fine. So the bile ducts are part of an organ called the liver. They are a network of tubes in the liver. Their role is to dispose of bile, which is a toxic fluid that that helps with digestion. Its job is to break down things so that we can digest when we eat. So it is highly toxic. The ducts are a waste disposal system, and you can imagine what happens when waste disposal breaks down. The toxic bile overflows into the liver and starts eating up the rest of the liver cells. So if you think about it, it's such a huge waste because the bile ducts and the bile duct cells, which are called cholangiocytes, make up 2 to 3% of the total liver mass. And because we can't repair this 2 to 3%, we have to throw away the whole liver. It's such a waste.
Mm-hmm. So and you this said, is why sorry, we you thought, said before that this like this kind of operation is the main reason why we have liver transplants, right? Or one third of
the... No, it depends on the cause.
Right.
But the important thing to remember is that a lot of these patients will progress to have a liver transplant.
Right.
And as a result, up to, let's say, 25 to 30% of liver transplants in the country are happening to help people with these diseases. Therefore, if we could somehow treat these diseases in an alternative way, that means that, let's say, a quarter to a third of the livers that we are using up would return to the common pool of organs and would help patients who suffer from other liver diseases. It would increase organ availability. So they are, however, the leading cause for transplantation in children. If you look at children liver transplants, 70% of those happen to treat diseases of these bile ducts. And so what we have done in the lab to try and address this problem is, first of all, we tried to grow the main cell type that these bile ducts are made up of. And it's the most important cell type because this is the cell type that protects from toxic bile. It makes them resistant to bile. It's a coating of these tubes that prevents bile from penetrating the surrounding tissue. So these cells are called cholangiocytes. First, we came up with a method to take small biopsies from patients, isolate and grow their bile duct cells. And we did that using a new technology, which is called organoid technology. So we take these cells, and conventionally you would put them in a plastic plate and let them grow as a monolayer, as a two-dimensional culture. What we do now is we grow them in 3D conditions. We grow them in a little hydrogel. It's an extracellular matrix. And as soon as the cells go into this hydrogel in 3D conditions, they form 3D structures, which are like little cysts or little bubbles made up of cells with a tiny lumen resembling the actual ducts which have a lumen, which are called organoids. This is a very extensively used system at the moment. Then we decided to go one step further and because cells are very useful to grow, but actually, how are you going to put them in the patients? For example, in children, as I said there, the leading cause for a liver transplant is the lack of what is called the common bile duct, the common outflow or the trunk of the biliary tree. All these tiny ducts converge to a very big tube called the common bile duct that takes bile out of the liver. Some children are born without it, and this is the leading cause for liver transplantation. So in that case, we have the cells, but what we would need is a tube to replace the tube that's gone. So for that, we started collaborating with our engineering team in Cambridge, and we came up with a method to generate bioengineered tissue. So use what we call a scaffold, which is a material for the cells to adhere to, which was tubular. So this is called the collagen scaffold, made out of a natural material, which is collagen. We created a collagen tube then, put our cells on the tube, and created a structure that resembled the human bile duct, which is called the bioengineered bile duct. And then we started transplanting in small animal models. And more recently, we are transplanting that in large animal models. And we have started to talk with biotech companies and the regulators to see if we can now start taking it into patients. And this is one application. The other application is that in some cases, and this is more common in adults, the damage doesn't affect big tubes that you can go in and correct as a surgeon by suturing in a new tube. Sometimes it affects the tiny, tiny branches of these tubes in the liver, these which are called intrahepatic ducts. So these tiny branches are not amenable to surgical reconstruction. And the problem there is that if you think of the lining of these tubes as a cobblestone, some cobbles have fallen off. It would be great if we had a way to repave them. This is what we've tried to do very recently, to find a way to access these ducts and inject into them a new coat of cells. And as our cells run into this cobblestone that's missing cobbles, they find the holes and fill them up and repair these ducts and make them again impermeable to bile, restoring the problem.
And
this is quite important.
So in terms
of, yeah, please.
I was just going to say, in terms of how this method compares to the previous method, so when you're growing the cells in the scaffold versus growing the cells so that they repair those cobblestones, is the same? Is it just the way that you grow these particular cells that changes, or is the whole method different, I guess?
No, that's a very good question. The cells are exactly the same, but on one occasion, there's an intermediate step, which is we grow a tube, we make a tube out of collagen, because collagen is a material that is very that our body makes. So we use this natural ingredient of the body, we make the cells into a tubular structure, and this is the extra step, and then we put them in the body. And what's really cool is that the collagen remodels after a while. So the body sees the collagen tube, does not recognize it as a foreign material because it's human collagen, but knows that it's not exactly as the body would make it. So what it does, it goes in and remodels it and makes it perfect for us. So it does most of the work for us. All we need to do is provide it with a starting material. On the other hand, the cells that we use as cobbles to repair the cobblestone are cells only. We don't have the intermediate step of putting them in a tube. Why? Because we are injecting them in an existing tube. You know, these tubes exist. They haven't been destroyed. They haven't been blocked. However, their lining, their coating, their cobbles have fallen off. And this is what we need to replace. So there we can just push the cells in and they will find the right places and attach.
Yeah. And so that's really interesting that you've got those two ways of solving the problem, either in a liver that is lacking those major bile duct tubes and perhaps a more damaged liver that needs some encouragement to maintain those smaller bile ducts. And it's really interesting how that you've managed to sort of figure all this out. And my question is, in these cases, are you taking liver tissue from the patient and then taking it to the lab and then returning it to the patient, or are the cells of origin different? And if they are different, do you ever have problems with rejection by the host tissue?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So you see, this is part of the research that we're doing at the moment. And you touched upon a very big question in the field. So whenever you want to take cells back to a patient, there's always concerns if you have to take cells which are not natural. So what, and this concerns is that you have to genetically manipulate, for example, stem cells, induced pluripotent stem cells, you have to genetically manipulate them. There's always a concern about cancer. The organoids that a lot of the people who work on primary organoids, including us, we're trying to address this issue by saying that we take primary cells, we do not do any genetic modification, so the genome is not affected, and then we return them back to the patient. However, the question that always arises is, ideally, we want to take the patient's own cells and return to the same patient to avoid immunosuppression. Because if it's someone else's cells, our body rejects them as a foreign graft. However, the problem is, okay, if I take my own cells and I'm a patient and I return them back to my body, well, I have the disease, don't I? So my cells are going to be defective anyway. So some of the recent work we've done is targeting exactly this. And here we're taking advantage of a unique feature. Well, it's not entirely unique, but of a feature that bile duct diseases have, which translates to some diseases, but not to every disease. What happens with these diseases is that they affect only specific parts of the bile ducts with specific cell types. Whilst in the same patient, you see that some bile ducts are affected, and these are the bile ducts that need changing or repairing, whilst others completely escape the disease. So what we are trying to figure out now, and we've done partly some of that in our recent publication, is how to change take the patient's own cells, which are from whichever area survives, and make sure that they maintain or they gain this identity of a cell that can resist damage, because this exists in the patient, because this is why some ducts survived in the first place. So all we want to do is take them out in the lab, educate them, and remind them to stay resistant, and then inject them back in the body. And so I think that's what we are aiming towards. Having said that, we have also looked, and this was quite an interesting piece of work. We have looked at whether we could help livers, repair livers outside the body, which have bile duct problems. And we know that these livers are slightly defective in the bile ducts, but because we have this method, we ask the question, would it be possible to take an organ which is not quite suitable for transplantation because of bile duct issues, repair its bile ducts, and return it back in the body in a refurbished state? And in that case, you don't need the patient's own cells, because the patient is going to get a liver that's coming from someone else anyway. In that case, you can use what we call non-autologous or allogeneic cells. So you could use a healthy individual's cells to repair a graft and then put it in the patient, because the patient was going to receive immunosuppression anyway, which is another approach. And we tried that in human livers, actually, outside the human body. So I think that was one of the first times that we managed to show that it is possible to use these cells to repair a human organ. Of course, we didn't transplant these livers due to ethical considerations, but we did do a lot of testing on them, and it did seem that we managed to recover some of their function.
That's really incredible and must make a huge difference to the availability of transplantable donor organs. All of this research is really focusing on the bile duct repair. Are there other organoid models that are being developed for the rest of the liver?
Absolutely. So there's a lot of groups that work on organoids that should be able to repair liver cells, what we call hepatocytes. And it's quite interesting, because all these techniques that we develop can be used as proof of principle, as sort of a pathfinder, put it this way, experiments, for then that other groups can plug in and repair their liver. But also in Adam Brooks and in other hospitals, we can perfuse other organs ex vivo. So what we know is that lungs can be perfused, hearts can be perfused, and certainly kidneys can be perfused ex vivo. And so this opens up new avenues. Because if you think about it, whatever happens whenever we are about to transplant a new cell type in a patient, we have these concerns. Do they work and are they safe? And we go to the regulators, and the regulators do their absolute best to make sure it's absolutely safe before it goes in patients. But the best they can ask of us is to test it in primates. But even if the cell works in a primate, we've had so many trials where something could be different in human. You can imagine how much more confidence or how much it would be easier for patients, if you want, to be able to test it in a human organ before we risk testing it in a patient and something going wrong. So I think that is what revolutionizes the field. And I think that's why we're very keen to help as many groups as possible to adopt this system and widely use it.
Yeah, that makes sense, definitely. And it's kind of almost truer to life, right? I mean, even though it might be ex vivo or like whatever, at least it's sort of human derived rather than, yeah, like you said, primate models and things like that. And I suppose this is more of a sort of professional question, but you're both a clinician and, you know, involved in scientific research. And what's it like being able to run those in tandem? Is it quite an interesting contrast, or is it something that actually slots together quite well?
It's fantastic, I think. It's what makes us go. You know, first of all, you get the best of both worlds. And both aspects can be very rewarding, but also it takes a lot of hard work. So when you find that the science is grinding you down, you can always go to the hospital and you get immediate satisfactions because you see patients who are feeling better. And when you see that some of your patients, unfortunately, you can't help yet because we still don't have everything that it takes, that really motivates you to go back in the lab. And, you know, even if your experiments didn't work last night, start anew if you want. And the other thing is, it's very multidisciplinary. It's not something that you ponder on your own and take forward on your own. It's a game, and you play with many other players. So whenever we have an idea to get, for example, human livers perfused outside the body, we thought about it, but then we went to our surgical colleagues and said, can we get the livers? And, you know, it's difficult at first to convince people, but the people in Addenbrooke are amazing. They are very, very innovative. So after a while, you get them on board, but they said, hang on, a liver is a very big organ. How are you going to get enough cells? So you scratch your head, you say, yeah, you know, you're right. It's a big problem. They say, but what if we get the radiologists to inject only a part of the liver? And sort of it snowballs from there on. How are we going to see what we achieved? Well, let's get the radiology team on board. So what starts with a small drawing on a piece of paper ends up being a massive endeavor. And everybody who comes in improves it and improves it and improves it more. And it's a fantastic journey, I think, by the end of it. And it's something you don't do on your own. And I think this is a general thing these days. Science and technology are advancing immensely. And I think it's, at least with my limited capacity, I don't think that one can be an expert in everything, because there's so much to know. So I think innovation, progress, lies at the interface, at being able to bring a lot of great minds together and maybe help a bit in the process, you know, and this is where you get mm-hmm. things to move forward.
No, that's really interesting that you going to say that. It's a theme that keeps coming up in a lot of these interviews that we do in the podcast, that people that, you know, might be working in a field that seems initially quite specific, you know, have all of these collaborations and all these ideas that come from speaking to people in different disciplines. And, you know, everyone says what you're saying now, that obviously the pace at which you can innovate and come to these new conclusions and experiments just like accelerates so much when you're talking to people that can give you a different perspective. So I guess as well, like specifically for what you're doing, I mean, it's not like you can develop any of this without actually, you know, we're getting the livers from the hospital. Like eventually you're going to have to apply this in real life. So it's really interesting to exactly. hear the process.
That's the beauty of working in the university in Cambridge. It's a very nice place, don't get me wrong. The facilities are fantastic, absolutely. There's a million nice places in the world and there's so many nice facilities. But it's this concentration in a very small area of all these great minds around you that you feel humbled in front of, and then you can go and approach them and say, I need some help. And this is where the true strength of these efforts is the fact that you can approach great minds and ask for their input on what you're doing, and they make it so much better.
It's such just fantastic approach. And when it comes to the, I mean, you have the great facilities here and all the technology and research facilities, but how expensive is it to actually implement the technology? Is it something that can be foreseeable to go worldwide and healthcare plans can afford it, or is it something that will still be very restricted?
That's a very good question, you know. And of course, having been a clinician for a bit of time, you get to appreciate that the only way to get a therapy to patients is to turn it into a product, because otherwise, you know, there needs to be companies that take it forward. So at the moment, we have been collaborating with one of the catapults. These are initiatives in the UK that try to accelerate therapies in different areas. We are collaborating with the cell and gene therapy catapult and a startup biotechnology. We founded around this technology called Belitech. And what we've done is we've tried to cost how much a bioengineered bile duct, what the cost of a bioengineered bile duct would be compared to liver transplantation. And we find that this could be as little as 10% of the cost of the original procedure, not of the actual transplant operation, however, of the lifelong cost, which is estimated to something like $500,000, or if you go in the US, something between $500,000 to $800,000. And of course, the cost of a bioengineered bile duct, which could get less, we never built this commercially, of course, but the estimate is that it would be around £50,000. So it's a significant cost saving. And of course, this is something that would need to be taken into consideration before taking it into patients.
The prices of non-funded healthcare are staggering.
Yeah, I think it's quite important. The other thing that makes it interesting is that if you've got a therapy, if we forget about the ducts and go into the cells, and if you've got a therapy that comes at a significant cost reduction, one of the beauties of it is that it can be repeated. One of the things I like about regenerative medicine is that it is slightly paradigm shifting in how it works as a treatment. So it is one of the very few cases in which we don't need to know the disease mechanism, exactly how the disease works, to go disrupt how the disease works so that we treat the patient. This is the best way, don't get me wrong, but it takes years and years. Whilst with regenerative medicine, what you can do is you appreciate the cell is broken. So what do? You replace the cells. And you give your patient a lease of life, a bridge, until such time when you know why are the cells breaking, and now I can intervene in the mechanism and stop them breaking long term, and I don't need to be replacing them anymore. But in the meanwhile, you're doing something for your patients. And if that comes as a significantly reduced cost compared to the gold standard treatment, that means you can keep providing them this bridge for a very long time, which is quite compelling, I think.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely amazing, and it shows how much sort of further forward we've come on in terms of transplant medicine and, you know, these new innovative techniques. And it's just been a real pleasure to sort of explore these organoid models that you've got and their application in both treating damaged livers as well as improving the quality of livers to be transplanted. And all of that, the sort of future applications of all of those sort of technologies. So I want to say thank you so much for joining us today. And yeah, brilliant. It's been brilliant to talk to you.
Very, very welcome. Excellent. Thank you.
Thanks so much again for listening to this episode with Dr. Fotis Sampatsiotis. We really, really enjoyed chatting to him about regenerative medicine and what role organoids can play in liver repair. We really want to know what you think of the podcasts, and if you have any questions or suggestions, drop us a line at BlueSciPod on Twitter, or you can also email us at bluescipodcast@gmail.com. See you next time.